Our top source, leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah, says Israeli regimes failed to sow division between Palestinian factions through its aggression on the Gaza Strip. Candidates in Turkey hold the final day of campaigning as country prepares for presidential and parliamentary elections slated for Sunday. And a former U.S. Marine has been charged with manslaughter over choking an African-American man to death on a New York City subway. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says Israel has failed to drive a wedge between Palestinian resistance groups through its latest aggression against the Gaza Strip. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says resistance groups have remained united and foiled enemy plots. He added, Israel's attacks on Gaza have also been a futile attempt to cover up the regime's internal crisis and restore its deterrent power. Nasrallah further said Lebanese resistance movement will not hesitate to support Palestinians in the face of Israel's deadly violence.
We are in constant contact with the leaders of the Palestinian factions, and we are monitoring their situation and all developments minute by minute. We are providing all possible help within certain limits. But I'd like to add that at any time, if the responsibility falls on us to make a move or more, we will not hesitate to do so, God willing.
The Hezbollah leader also denounced the international community's silence on Israeli crimes against Palestinians. Elsewhere, he touched upon the normalization of ties between Syria and Arab countries, saying rapprochement has brought positive results for the region and called on Lebanon to restore ties with Syria as soon as possible. Our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, explains in more detail the Hezbollah leader's stance on supporting Palestinian resistance groups.
And of course, when it comes to the stance of Hezbollah as a resistance, he said that they are in contact minute by minute with the Palestinian resistance, and they are following up, of course, on a minute by minute everything that's happening, and are giving limited assistance. However, he did mention, which is something very significant and would of course reverberate with the Israelis, which is that Hezbollah, whenever they feel necessary to take any measure or any steps in assistance or to give assistance to the resistance, then they will not hesitate. So that is something that I think we will see a lot of analysis from the Israeli side on what the type of assistance that Hezbollah might give, other than the fact that they have extending arms, they are giving logistic support, they are giving financial support, they are giving political and moral support. What type of assistance could Hezbollah, what more can Hezbollah do in order to give assistance to the Palestinian resistance?
And the death toll from Israel's strikes on the Gaza Strip continues to rise as the regime pounds besieged Palestinian territory for a fourth consecutive day. Now, latest Israeli airstrikes targeted a residential building in Al-Nasser neighborhood of western Gaza. According to the health ministry, attack killed two people and left several injured. So far, 33 Palestinians, including women and children, have been killed. Nearly 150 others have been injured. Resistance groups, including Islamic Jihad, have responded by firing a barrage of missiles into occupied territories. One Israeli has died and dozens have been injured as a result. Palestinians say the retaliatory strikes will continue until Israel stops its policy of assassinating resistance leaders. Meanwhile, Hamas said silence of the international community emboldens Israel to continue this aggression. Our Gaza correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, tells us about the dire situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip.
The Israeli regime started this onslaught on Tuesday around 2 a.m. by assassinating two top Islamic Jihad military commanders, and not only they assassinated the commanders, they also killed their families, their wives and children. This is what Israel has been doing for 4 days now, attacking Islamic Jihad military commanders and on purpose killing their wives and kids in blatant violation of international law and international humanitarian law. Israel also keeps the crossings into the Gaza Strip sealed also for 4 days now, causing a humanitarian crisis that is in the making. as Gaza is running short on food supplies and also running short on fuel for the solar power generating plant, and also running short on medicines for hospitals and clinics. When we talk to people, they tell you there is some sort of international conspiracy of silence towards Israeli crimes, not this time, but over, especially for Gaza, since 2007 with the ongoing hermetic Israeli blockade, as well as multiple wars since 2008 that claimed the lives of thousands of innocent civilians, including hundreds of women and children. Just 2 years ago, Israel killed over 250 Palestinians in Gaza and destroyed entire neighborhoods during a sort of Al-Quds battle that started on May 11th, 2022, and ended on May 21st. And people right now are comparing what's happening in Gaza now with this onslaught to the war in 2022 because of the similarities between the two wars.
And Iran's foreign minister has strongly condemned latest Israeli aggression on Gaza as flagrant violation of human rights. Hossein Amir Abdollahian says assassination of resistance leaders and killing of innocent civilians shows Israel's desperation and vulnerability in the face of Palestinian resistance. He made the remarks in a phone call with head of the political bureau of the Gaza-based Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas. Ismail Haniyeh said the resistance groups are fully prepared and coordinated to counter the aggression, and Israel has no choice but to surrender. Amir Abdollahian was also on the phone with Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad Movement, another resistance group in Gaza. Top Iranian diplomat called for international support for the resistance groups. Ziad al-Nakhala vowed Palestinians will stand up to the aggression until it stops and Israel accepts Palestinians' terms. About 2 days ahead of the presidential election in Turkey, incumbent President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his rival Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu have held campaign events to encourage their respective supporters to come out and vote this Sunday. Erdogan plans to rally supporters in a historically conservative district of Istanbul before meeting the faithful at the opening of a new mosque there. It comes as his rival Kılıçdaroğlu has received a boost after the withdrawal of an opposition candidate from the crucial race on Thursday. During the campaign, Kılıçdaroğlu accused Russia of interfering in the election on Erdogan's behalf, a claim strongly dismissed by the Kremlin. Meanwhile, Erdogan's accused the West of bankrolling his opponents in an effort to undermine Turkish sovereignty. Opinion polls show Kılıçdaroğlu with a slight lead over Erdogan. Race can go to a runoff come May 28th if neither candidate surpasses the 50% threshold needed to win. Author and activist Fra Hughes tells us how the significance of Turkey's elections goes far beyond its borders.
It's not just the most important election in Turkey's recent history. It is actually the most important election across the whole region. If we look back to the 15th of July, 2016, America under Obama and Biden tried a failed coup against Erdogan. They tried to install Gulen, who was a resident in the United States of America. Erdogan called out the people onto the streets to fight the coup, and that's what the people did. So even in 2016, we were seeing that the American administration was trying to get rid of Erdogan, and what they did was actually push him closer to Russia, closer to China, and with the rapport between Saudi Arabia and Iran, he has moved closer to Syria and those other two countries. So what's at stake here is actually the whole future of the Middle East, not just the future of Turkey, its government and its election. Erdogan is moving closer to a wider Arab Persian collective. He is moving closer to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He is moving closer to Eurasia and BRICS. This is the future not only for the region, but it is the future for Turkey. Now, the Americans want to get rid of Erdogan, and what they have done is they have consolidated and coalesced all the opposition around Erdogan's main competitor in this presidential election. These people, if elected, that new president will be pro-NATO. I would expect him to start giving armaments to the Ukraine. I would expect him to start causing more destabilization in Syria and to actually distance Turkey from this new Eurasian center and economic political powerhouse that's coming into being.
Former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has been released on bail for 2 weeks by the Islamabad High Court after his Tuesday arrest on corruption charges sparked deadly nationwide protests. Court also granted bail to Khan in other pending cases and forbade the anti-corruption body from arresting him again during this period. The Supreme Court had ruled his arrest invalid and unlawful a day earlier. And upon his release, Khan said the judiciary was Pakistan's only protection against what he called the law of the jungle. Khan, who leads a major political party in Pakistan, described his arrest as abduction, saying that he was treated like a terrorist. The former premier's arrest sparked violent protests throughout the country that left at least 9 people dead. Thousands of protesters have also been arrested throughout the unrest. A former American military officer who recently killed a homeless black man on a New York subway has been charged with second-degree manslaughter. Daniel Penny was arraigned in a criminal court in Manhattan after handing himself over to police. Former white Marine was later released on bond. He could face up to 15 years in prison if found guilty for the death of Jordan Neely. Penny killed Neely after putting him in a deadly chokehold on a subway on the 1st of May. Incident sparked widespread protests throughout the city. Demonstrators decried Neely's death an act of lynching and an example of white vigilantism. They also called for justice for Neely. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has urged Congress to raise the nation's debt ceiling to ward off an economic crisis. Yellen called on legislators to increase the $31.4 trillion federal debt limit to avert an unprecedented default that will trigger a domestic as well as global economic downturn. Now, her comments came after President Joe Biden warned that the country could very well slip into recession if lawmakers fail to raise the debt ceiling.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urged Congress to raise the $31.4 trillion debt limit and avert an unprecedented default, saying that a failure to do so would have dire consequences. Yellen's comments come after she warned of an economic catastrophe if the U.S. fails to raise its debt ceiling in the coming weeks. She has also previously warned that the U.S. could fail to meet its debt obligations sooner than expected, and it may run out of measures as early as June 1. Yellen issued the latest in a series of increasingly stark warnings in remarks prepared for a press conference meeting in Japan with her counterparts from the group of 7 G7 rich nations, as well as India, Indonesia, and Brazil. Yellen's comments came as a political stalemate over raising the debt limit was forcing the Treasury Department dangerously close to worst-case scenario, which is a potential U.S. debt default.
The notion of defaulting on our debt is something that would so badly undermine the U.S. and global economy that I think it should be regarded by everyone as unthinkable.
In order to avoid a default on the nation's debt, Congress must vote to either raise or suspend the debt limit before the Treasury runs out of emergency funding. But with only days left this month, time is running out to reach a deal. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. The last time this happened, the U.S. saw its credit rating downgraded and interest rates on its existing debt go up. Even if the nation avoids tumbling over the fiscal cliff, the U.S. economy could suffer.
They're doing the best, to the best of my knowledge, what no other political party has done in the nation's history. They're literally, not figuratively, holding the economy hostage by threatening to default on our nation's debt that we've already incurred.
Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. Now, if the limit is not raised by June 1st deadline, U.S. may very well default on its debt payments, which in turn could touch off a global economic catastrophe.
The debt ceiling is the maximum amount the U.S. government is legally authorized to borrow to meet its obligations. Many investors are bracing for the economic fallout of the deadline for the U.S. to raise the debt ceiling or default on its obligations. The U.S. government has run a deficit averaging nearly $1 trillion every year since the year 2001, meaning that it spends that much more money than it receives in taxes and other revenues.
Congress has told Treasury, you should pay our bills, you should pay our debt. But at the same time, it's told it, you can't borrow anymore to pay those bills and debt. And at the same time, Congress has authorized all of the spending that's being done. So the spending's going out the door. The bills are showing up at Treasury, and Treasury isn't getting enough revenue from taxpayers to pay the bills. And so there's a lot of hand-wringing over what Treasury should do.
Even short of a default, hitting the debt ceiling would stop the government's ability to finance its operations, including providing for the national defense or funding entitlements such as Medicare or Social Security. The default could cause the loss of 3 million jobs, add $130,000 to the cost of an average 30-year mortgage, and raise interest rates enough to increase the national debt by $850 billion. Meanwhile, the recent turmoil in the banking industry have concerned investors. In early May, officials closed San Francisco-based First Republic Bank, making it the third U.S. bank to collapse in the past 2 months. Most of First Republic's assets are being acquired by J.P. Morgan, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank, whose clients were mostly from the tech industry, collapsed in March under similar circumstances. But they are not alone. The U.S. Federal Reserve has revealed that 722 banks reported unrealized losses exceeding 50% of their capital at the end of the third quarter of 2022. Those losses have occurred because banks bought lots of treasuries and bonds when interest rates were near zero. Now, as the Federal Reserve raises rates to combat inflation, the value of these bonds has declined.
And that's a wrap for your latest. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has renewed bombing Gaza after killing 13 Palestinians. Two more people are killed in the first strike, taking the day's death toll to 15. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, the Zionist regime fighter jets renewed their bombing of the Gaza Strip recently, hours after killing 13 people, including 10 civilians. Local media reported that an air raid targeted a vehicle in Qarara town in Khan Yunis, near the eastern fence separating Gaza and the occupied territories, resulting in two additional fatalities, bringing the day's total death toll to 15. The Zionist regime military said that the strike targeted an anti-tank guided missile cell. The attack followed several raids by the Israeli regime military in Gaza, which began shortly after 2 a.m. local time and killed at least 4 children, 5 women, and 3 Palestinian Islamic Jihad commanders. Another 22 people were wounded in the morning raid, including 3 children and 7 women, some of whom are in a serious and critical condition. In response, the Joint Operations Room, JOR, an umbrella body of armed factions in Gaza, including Hamas and PIJ, issued a statement warning that the Zionist regime will pay the price for the raids. Meanwhile, hundreds of Israelis living in cities near the Gaza border have evacuated to the other parts of the territory, anticipating reprisal attacks. Bomb shelters have been opened and roads and beaches have been closed. Netanyahu said that he had ordered the targeting of the Islamic Jihad leaders following the recent rocket fire and that Israel prepared for any possibility. Palestinian armed groups had fired rockets towards the occupied territories following the death of Palestinian prisoner Khadr Adnan in an Israeli regime prison following nearly 3 months of hunger strike. A brief exchange of fire ensued, leaving one Palestinian killed and two Israelis wounded. The Islamic Jihad is considered the second largest armed group in the Gaza Strip behind Islamic Resistance Movement of Hamas, which governs the enclave. The group said in a statement that a response to the Zionist regime aggression will not take long. The recent airstrikes were the largest attack mounted by the fabricated regime of Israel against Gaza since August last year, when the military assassinated senior PIJ commander Taysir al-Jabari, triggering a three-day exchange of fire. At least 49 Palestinians were killed in 2022 Israeli regime bombardment, including 17 children, and 360 others were wounded. Meanwhile, Middle East Eye reported Ahmad Asaf and Rani Qatanat were killed in a raid on Qabtia town near the city of Jenin. The Zionist regime forces killed two Palestinians in a dawn raid on the town of Qabtia in the occupied West Bank recently. The Palestinian Health Ministry identified the two men as Ahmad Jamal Tawfiq Asaf, a 19-year-old from Qabtia, and Rani Walid Qatanat, a 24-year-old resident of Jenin refugee camp. The Zionist regime forces sprayed a vehicle with bullets, killing Assad and Qatanat and wounding three others, according to local reports. The Zionist regime military said in a statement that assailants opened fire at IDF troops from a vehicle, and the troops responded with live fire. Eyewitnesses said a large army force raided the town near the northern city of Jenin under a heavy presence of drones and closed down the town's main streets. The Zionist regime forces ordered cars not to move through loudspeakers and stormed a number of Palestinian homes and surrounded others. Heavy gunfire and explosions were heard around the town as fighting then broke out between the Zionist regime forces and armed residents, eyewitnesses said. The incident brings the total number of Palestinians killed by Zionist regime forces so far this year to 108. A total of 19 Israelis have been killed over the same period. The recent raid comes a day after a series of Zionist regime strikes in the Gaza Strip killed three Islamic Jihad commanders and 12 civilians, including four children, leaving the two sides braced for a flare-up. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported Israeli regime bulldozers recently demolished two Palestinian-owned apartments in the town of Jabal al-Mukabber in the occupied city of Al-Quds under the pretext that they were built without a permit. According to sources, the two apartments were 220 square meters each, owned by brothers Faraz and Ali Shugairat and inhabited by 10 people, mostly children. Faraz said that he had received a demolition notice from the Zionist regime authorities last February, and that all the attempts to prevent the demolition of his apartment and his brother Ali's apartment were unsuccessful, pointing out that the occupation municipality court issued a decision about 2 months ago to freeze the demolition decision until next September. but he and his brother were informed by the lawyer last week that the municipality had submitted a request to the court to cancel the freezing decision, and the court approved the demolition.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and let us reflect on some wise words from the paragon of virtue, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. The believers should not dishonor, betray, accuse, disappoint, or disavow each other.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, what is the practical treatment to save us from meanness? In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure, immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salaamu Alaikum, dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to A to Z in Islamic Lifestyle, IRIB English Radio, Color of Islam page. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you with me for this session. So, we are going to start our program with a very important question. That is, I say that I suffer from the complex of meanness. What is a practical treatment to save me from it and from its bad effects? So to answer this question, we need to know that firstly, you should recognize the cause so that the treatment can be easy. Here, we're going to offer the main causes of this complex first. Number one is either you are imagining it or others are making you imagining it. Either we imagine that we are meanless or other people around us are making us imagine it this way. This is one of the causes. And also, repeated failures in life and not achieving an aim that was once in our dream makes us feel meanless. So it's very important to recognize the cause of such a feeling. And then when we recognize the reason, when we recognize the cause, the treatment can be very easy because the cause is clear to us. So in the next part, we are going to mention the solution for this kind of feelings. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z IRIB English Radio, Color of Islam, page, and Farhad, your host, and we are going to continue our program talking about the solutions and the practical treatment to save us from feeling meaningless. In the previous part, we talked about the causes of feeling meaningless, and that was either we imagine that we are meaningless, or others are making us imagining this way. And secondly, repeated failures in life and not achieving an aim that was once in our dream makes us feel this way. But for the cure, we can suggest the following principles. We are going to mention them. First, try to achieve success in your life to strengthen your moral, and then you can aim for another success and a bigger step. Secondly, read some books regarding this topic in order to achieve some success by reading religious books or every other books that regards to this topic. We learn how to struggle with such feelings, and it's really, really helpful. And number three, we need to seize any opportunity to prove our personality in a lawful way. I do not mean that you seize others' opportunities or show off by doing good. Number four, if you want to mention, we need to persuade ourselves that we are a successful person by assistance of Allah. So believing in Allah, it's a very, very important element that we, by the help of that, we can get rid of from this feelings. And number five, do not forget that make your intentions sincere and just for the sake of Allah when doing goodness, because this is the moral secret of everlasting success and progress. So if we try to make our intention just for the sake of Allah, we will never get worried about what others think about us. And in this way, it's a secret, it's a golden secret. We have it in our religion through Quran and Hadiths. We understand that this way of thinking, this way of living, and if we establish our life based on this very important principle, we never feel meaningless, inshallah. So I hope everyone a happy life. Thank you for staying with us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Era of Trumpism.
Part 2.
If products do not get across borders, soldiers will be crossing them.
The sheer unpredictability of a President Donald Trump.
How unpredictable the new terrain here in Washington is.
Is this our new normal? Is there reason for the creation of a new reality?
Donald Trump has broken the rules of what it means to be president.
What Trump are we going to see, do you think?
Going to constantly have rules that are broken in my way or the highway.
If we call it a political earthquake and unraveling of the system.
Now, in order to figure out how Trump wanted to use his expertise and skills in marketing and negotiating in the political sphere, we'd better take a glance at the list of his advisors. Harold Hamm, a renowned American capitalist involved in the field of oil and gas business, the 39th richest person in the United States and the 98th richest person in the world. Daniel Ralph D'Amico, the former chairman of Nucor Company, the biggest producer of steel in the world. Stephen Turner Mnuchin, an investment banker, film producer, and chief of financial affairs in Trump's election team. Stephen Ross, a Jewish billionaire involved in real estate development, Howard Mark Lorber, a Jewish capitalist involved in real estate development and one of the business leaders in the tobacco industry, John Alfred Paulson, a Republican billionaire, Peter Navarro, the only academic economist in Trump's team of advisors, and the only economic policy advisor to Trump who has a doctorate degree in economics. Navarro is also an expert on trade with China. Stephen Moore, an economic analyst and a main figure in the conservative Heritage Foundation research institution, which is known to the public as an advocate of capitalism. It is interesting to get to know some of the well-known international brands which Trump used their leaders as his economic policy advisors after winning the presidential election. In fact, the important issue is not that Trump chose these people as his economic policy advisors. What is more important is that the managers of these brands run the president's strategic and policy forum. Trump's unprecedented decision, though not being new in the history of the United States presidential elections, brings up numerous questions due to the present conditions in the country. Trump, anyhow, has taken power into his hands.
Do solemnly swear.
This person, despite being an alien in the world of politics, is considered to be an international player in the field of trade, entrepreneurship, and marketing. Is this a new playground drawn by think tanks advocating the West's capitalist system, led by the United States of America? The president had promised to take tough measures against countries that had breached the international trade deals with the U.S. and slap new tariffs on them. In addition, he vowed to file complaints at the World Trade Organization against countries that violated the trade terms. In this regard, Trump pointed his finger at China, claiming that that country had imposed unfair fiscal policies to manipulate exchange rates and control its currency's fluctuations.
China.
What China has done to the United States, it's one of the greatest thefts
in the history of the world.
If I'm going to instruct my Treasury Secretary to label China a currency manipulator.
Trump has set competition with China as a top priority of his administration's foreign policy. This issue can not only have an impact on the U.S. economy, it can also create financial challenges for the global economy as well. This is because after World War II, China's economy became dependent on U.S. financial resources, and the U.S. economy became dependent on China's workforce and resources, creating the foundation of the world economy following the Cold War. China, on the other hand, has publicly announced that it is not in favor of a trade war with any country, not even the United States. However, it added that if a country should ever decide to engage in a trade war with China, Beijing would be prepared for it, and it was fully confident that the Chinese nation would prevail. To this point, everything seemed to be normal. However, what made it unusual was that Trump chose a provocative title for his program, and his decision to actually launch the program made it even more absurd. Trump announced that his economic policy would be to make America great again. And to achieve this, he would place U.S. economic interests first and foremost above other factors in outlining his administration's foreign policy in regard to globalization. He chose U.S. first as his campaign slogan. However, the question that comes to mind here is that is it possible for the leader of the globe's capitalist system to take a stand against globalization? During the election campaign, by stating economic slogans in line with protectionist policies, he managed to gain the vote of non-Americans, Muslims, Mexicans, and immigrant labor forces, in addition to the traditional conservatives. He also bagged the votes of those who were unemployed, as well as the victims of layoffs in previously industrial states. The workers in these states, which traditionally supported the Democratic Party, have been made redundant after U.S. companies moved their businesses out of the country. The U.S. states that lost their industries were known as the Rust Belt states. Trump got their votes.
We love Nevada. We love Nevada.
In reality, these were the people who had become disillusioned with the liberal democratic system governing the country. The system, based on democratic liberalism, also had other limitations in the U.S., which led to Trump gaining more votes. The most important factor was the influence of money and the candidate's direct or indirect connections to big corporations and financial institutions, as well as the wealthy people and industrial groups in society. Trump believes that the United States of America is facing demise due to the mistakes the U.S. made in its foreign policy, in particular the U.S. commitments to international deals.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it.
Failed wars and multinational trade deals. Trump believes that the role played by the U.S. in the process of globalization has been financially detrimental to the U.S. citizens. To fight this, he believes that the current political order must be put aside. Now, is this good news? It is really strange that the elected president of the United States of America, who is at the helm of the capitalist system, opposes globalization. One of Trump's campaign slogans was America First.
It's going to be only America First. America First.
However, Trump and his team do not explain how they plan to carry out their promises in the current exiting structure of globalized capitalism. How do they plan to manage direct investments abroad by the United States and other countries' investments in the USA? How are they going to deal with monopolies and multinational firms? If other countries retaliate, what will become of U.S. digital industries, which have notable presence across the globe? Protests in Trump's America indicate that he is facing many problems in the political structure of the country, and his rivals are urging him to not change course from traditional U.S. foreign policy. What will the result of this political push and pull be is unclear. The legitimacy crisis and contradictions inherent to the liberal democratic system will exacerbate the situation.
Put the whole thing to bed earlier this year.
Another contradiction lies in Trump's protectionist policies, which obviously run contrary to the strategies pursued by international capitalist institutions, such as the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization, which the U.S. has played an important role in the establishment of. For example, how can the U.S. impose tariffs to stop the imports of goods from other countries, while urging the return of local investment, and not expect to see any reaction from foreign countries? China, the European Union, and Canada have already announced their commitment to free trade and warned that they would retaliate if restrictions were placed upon them by another country. Trump has not clarified how he would be able to stop the digital industry giants like Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and others from investing across the globe, given the huge profits they have reaped in from globalization. Undoubtedly, these companies will be the main ones opposed to Trump in comparison to the governments. Trump's use of his expertise in business and marketing is not limited to China alone. For example, a Trump advisor has promised Britain that as soon as the country pulls itself out of the European Union, London will be placed at the top of the list ahead of others in future trade deals with the U.S. Trump has attempted to limit trade with some countries in the world. But why? Right after he came to power, Trump started to take a number of risky moves. One of those moves, which he had promised during the election campaign, was to withdraw the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was signed by a dozen countries after 7 years of negotiations. It is natural for a president of a country to cancel a deal due to unfavorable conditions for that country. However, this deal was set aside at a time when Trump had not yet offered an alternative deal and simply said that the U.S. had better not deal with these countries. Trump has tried to renegotiate the conditions of all the deals that the United States has signed with other countries, attempting to revise them. Initially, there were rumors about the cancellation of NAFTA, a trade deal between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Shortly later, however, it was announced that he wanted to renegotiate the terms of the deal. Trump did the same with the internationally signed Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. In a few moments, I will sign a presidential memorandum to begin reinstating U.S. nuclear sanctions on the Iranian regime. We will be instituting the highest level.
The important point here is that by observing a small portion of what Trump's America offers to the world, one sees that it is none other than the White House itself which is opposed to the liberal world order. On the other hand, it justifies why the U.S. considers sanctions as its most effective tool in a direct economic war waged against Iran. Because this way, Iran is forced to limit its trade deals to just one or just a few countries. This limitation has made the Iranian economy vulnerable, forcing it to do one-fourth of its trade capacity with one trade partner alone, namely China. Meanwhile, Iran is among the top 20% of the world economies. Its population is 1% of the global population. Given these facts, Iran should be doing between 1.2 to 1.5% of world trade. That means it should be doing three times the trade volume it is doing today. On the other hand, despite having no trade with the U.S. and not being a trade partner to that country, economic changes in the United States caused by international trade do impact businesses and economic trends in Iran.
Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo! Will be our credo!
Nevertheless, the prescription that will pull us through the crises caused by the globalization process is achieving the goals set in the Iran 1404 Outlook document, general policies related to resistance economy and growth plans. A local prescription that will take us safely through the era of Trumpism during the globalization process.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
There are reports that food prices in the UK have skyrocketed again. Soaring costs for basic essentials have led to a decline in living standards in Britain. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Sky News reported British households have been hit with a record jump in food prices as decades high inflation continues to cripple the economy, according to the latest figures from the British Retail Consortium, BRC. A report by the trade body which represents UK supermarkets showed recently that fresh food prices soared by 17.8% in April on an annual basis, while prices for tinned goods and other store cupboard items accelerated by 12.9%. According to the BRC Nielsen IQ Shop Price Index, prices were up 8.8% last month compared to the same period in the previous year, while slightly down from 8.9% in March. Overall, shop price inflation eased slightly in April due to heavy spring discounting in clothing, footwear and furniture, BRC Chief Executive Helen Dickinson was quoted as saying by Sky News. However, food prices remained elevated given ongoing cost pressures throughout the supply chain, she added. Dickinson indicated that some goods such as ready meals have been seeing price rises due to knock-on effect from increased production and packaging costs. Meanwhile, head of retail and business insight at Nielsen IQ, Mike Watkins, noted that with inflation yet to peak and sales volumes mostly in decline, it's difficult to second-guess the strength of consumer confidence. Official figures showed last month that the rate of inflation in Britain had eased slightly but still remains above 10%, with food costs at a 45-year high. According to Trussell Trust charity, almost 3 million emergency food parcels have been handed out at UK food banks in the past year, with the number provided for children topping a million for the first time. The Bank of England's chief economist, Hugh Peel, stated earlier that British households and businesses needed to accept that they are poorer and should stop asking for wage increases and pushing prices higher. Meanwhile, Guardian noted on the bank's Monetary Policy Committee, some officials are becoming uncomfortable over the pace of rate increases from the record low 0.1% in December 2021. Many British households are yet to see the full impact, given that most mortgage holders fixed their borrowing costs for at least 2 years. However, more people are rolling off cheap deals struck in the past into the new high rate world. An estimated 1.7 million mortgages will hit the end of their fixed term this year, landing borrowers with a dramatic rise in their monthly payments. Amid fears over the fallout from the worst banking crisis since 2008 in the U.S., and with the cost of living crisis squeezing British households, these are all strong potential headwinds for the UK economy, so strong they could even tame inflation without the need for significantly higher rates. In the US, investors are betting the Federal Reserve has reached the apex of its rate increase cycle after a quarter point rise last week to between 5% and 5.25%, the highest level for 16 years. The European Central Bank is also thought to be close to its peak after increasing the deposit rate by a quarter point to 3.25% last week. The Bank of England is widely expected to follow suit. UK inflation remained stubbornly high at 10.1% in March, almost a full percentage point higher than the bank's forecast, and almost twice the rate in the US, as soaring food prices kept up the pressure on the struggling families. Alongside the delayed impact of soaring energy costs for food production now feeding through to the supermarket shelves, some observers warn that companies are profiteering, adding a greedflation layer to the cost of living crisis in Britain. Late last year, the fear was that the worst hit to living standards since the 1950s would force a sharp retrenchment by consumers. Business confidence was wafer thin, while the disastrous Liz Truss premiership made matters worse. Fast forward 6 months and economic growth is far from stellar, but a damaging recession also looks to have been avoided. Economists at Goldman Sachs reckon falls in the wholesale energy and food prices will bring down inflation, but that a far more resilient growth performance could ensure the reading sticks firmly above the bank's 2% target. As a result, Threadneedle Street's final rate increase could still be some month into the future. For households and businesses already struggling with high borrowing costs, that spells more discomfort to come for British households. Midstream.
Did not put the fate of our countries and peoples in the hands of the foreigner, but we bet on the victory of truth in the end, and we won the bet. This is how Syrian President Bashar al-Assad addressed Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi during the latter's visit to Damascus last week. The Syrian president's words summarized the origin and depth of the bilateral strategic relationship that linked the two allied countries since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979. At that time, Arab regimes were moving to a position that contradicts and confronts the aspirations of Syria and the Arab Liberation Forces, leaving Damascus alone in facing the projects of the American and Israeli colonialists and their tools that began to multiply in the region. Also at that time, Iran was moving from the position of the exclusive agent of the colonizer and the guardian of his interests in the region to the position of Palestine, to where Syria stood. Therefore, it was necessary for the hands to extend between the